Bristol is our community.
What a piece of luck. We start our election campaign today.
Elections? In this place?
Of course, we make our choice every 12 months. Every citizen has a choice. Are you going to run?
Like blazes, the first chance I get.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The High Court has squashed local objectors and given the go-ahead for the expansion of Bristol Airport, just as the government say they want to reduce fossil fuels. Hilary Byrne from Stop Bristol Airport Expansion Campaign explains how this curious decision was made. And it's the 200th anniversary of the Luddites this month. They were a well-organised movement of machine breakers in the north of England. We hear about a forgotten BBC Bristol children's series on a Luddite theme. And in the light of the Occupy camps in London, Bristol and elsewhere in Britain and in other parts of the world, we look at some of Britain's historical social justice movements. Plus, from the privatisation of land to the privatisation of war. Former MI5 officer Annie Machon talks about some of the secret techniques of modern spies and how her job, to a large extent, is being privatised. And, rolled over from last week, we take another look at invite-only leadership charity Common Purpose. They train local authorities, the BBC, the police and other public services. But is there a conflict of interest when some of their graduates in public office place orders for more training from guess who? Common Purpose. Or are some of their courses so good it's public money well spent? Well, to begin with, last week the High Court dismissed the final judicial review into North Somerset's decision to grant Bristol Airport planning permission for their expansion plans. Meanwhile, the government says it's trying to reduce pollution, noise and dependence on fossil fuels. So to get to the bottom of this, I'm joined now by Hilary Byrne, who's from the campaign group Stop Bristol Airport Expansion. Hi Hilary, welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, how did you get involved in campaigning? I take it that you live very local to the airport.
Yeah, I'm local to the airport and I'm also chair of the Parish Council Airport Association, 26 parishes then, and fighting the airport expansion plans.
Okay, so what are they actually planning, the airport authorities there? Because we've got one big long runway. As you're going past there, it doesn't look as if there's any particular need for more expansion there. You've got planes coming in from time to time, but it certainly doesn't look too dense.
The airport figures this year are going to be down on their peak, which was 2008, so there doesn't actually need the expansion at the moment, which is rather frustrating because they've just got permission and they're going to go ahead and build three new aircraft stands.
So the aircraft stands is what they're building. That actually really isn't going to affect things too much, though, is it? I mean, you've got aircraft coming in and coming out. They've got to park them somewhere.
It is going to affect it because we're going to have journeys to and fro the airport through local villages. We're going to have 17 hectares of greenbelt land which could be used for food production or agriculture in some sort as a giant car park. We're going to have more noise day and night.
Can you just tell us how, as a local resident, how it actually affects you living near the airport, other than the noise? Because I know around that area, there seems to be quite a lot of people who kind of tarmac over fields and things like that to allow kind of alternative car parks to the official car parks. It's so expensive there.
There's actually very few alternative car parks at the moment because the policy of North Somerset Council is only to let the airport have greenbelt land for car parking. So they are actually closing down farmers. So they're creating a monopoly for the airport just to have the sole car parking rights.
And how long have you actually been campaigning down there?
We've been campaigning for 6 years. 2005 was a community statement of intent which actually showed the airport's plans, and the numbers then was 5.2 million passengers per annum and they want to grow to 10 million at 2019. So effectively they're doubling in size.
But for those living in those parishes that you represent, surely when they buy a house near an airport, they realise that it's possible that in the future their lives and their property prices may be blighted by an airport in the vicinity.
Yeah, I agree that's true. That's if you're buying a property. But what has happened is this has taken us by great surprise, this planning application, because they'd grown so much since, so much since 2000. They're only 2 million, and then suddenly, 2 million at 2000, and then suddenly they're at 5 million at 2005. We haven't got the surface access to the airport. Most airports have dual carriageways and rail, and we don't want the beautiful countryside ruined by that.
What about the idea of moving some of the air traffic that's going on there up to Filton? I mean, Filton's a longer runway, and also was probably, I mean, I'm sure it was built long before Lulsgate, down sort of in the direction of sort of Weston-super-Mare down that way.
We never ever push the carbon emission problem, the more traffic on the roads, to other airports. So we are not going to go and say it should go somewhere else. We say there should be no more expansion of airports generally.
Now, tell us about this decision last week then. What did the judge actually say, and what were you asking him?
We were asking...
Or her.
It was a him. It was Mr. Judge Collins. We were asking him to view climate change, greenhouse gases, as a material consideration in the planning application. This means that the district councillors would have to consider that point. It wasn't.
But why is that?
Because the Air Transport White Policy, which was a paper for, published in 2003, was a domineering policy. And he agreed that was still the policy, even though the new coalition government is forming a new aviation policy, which said clearly the Air Transport White Paper is out of date and does not give enough emphasis to climate change and noise.
So were you scratching your head last week, really wondering how on earth could he come to this conclusion?
We were. We really were. And it is entirely frustration, because you have to go back to the planning application. Over 5,000 people objected. Two local authorities, Bristol City Council, Bath and North East Somerset District Council, a primary hare kelp trust, NGOs such as RSPB, the Wildlife Fund, all objected to this application because of the environmental damage. And yet North Somerset passed it because they knew the airport would appeal the decision, and they didn't want costs against it.
Martin, do you want to come in here? Because we've got a very peculiar decision, it seems, made there at the High Court, when there's actually quite a lot of evidence from all sorts of expert bodies that this is not the right way to go, and yet still it seems that the developer kind of trumps everything.
Well, that's the problem with the planning law. I mean, they can appeal, but if this decision went against them, you can't appeal against them. It's very much... what goes on in this country is very much in favour of developers. I mean, we've got a free market capitalist economy, and basically, you know, business decides.
But at the end of the day, quite often people find it difficult even to get an extension for their home, whereas big projects like this always seem to go through.
God is on the side of the big battalions.
There is a presumption in favour of the developer now, and the new planning regulations under the National Planning Framework, is it going to be even worse? The presumption's going to be written in.
Well, one of the things that they're saying about the airport, and this is the airport's chief executive, Robert Sinclair, is that since North Somerset Council recommended approval of the airport's development plans, the British government and now the English courts have found no grounds to challenge or appeal this outcome, or the process by which it's recently adds. It's now time to work to ensure we continue to meet the demand for travel to and from the southwest, providing the connectivity which is vital to the region's prosperity. Now, you know, you could be seen in all this as really trying to stop people travel, and also trying to put the brakes on prosperity.
We're certainly not trying to stop people travelling or flying. People can fly now, and that doesn't matter. We are only stopping further expansion. Connectivity is here. You can go through the hubs of Amsterdam, you can go to America through Dublin, so you can get anywhere in the world. There's over 100 destinations from Bristol Airport. Well, if you went one flight a year, you'd live to 100. If you did two a year, it would take 50 years to go to all their destinations. So why do we want more when there's so much environmental damage?
So where does the campaign go from here?
Well, the government is doing a public consultation on its new aviation policy in March. We will be asking all our supporters and parishes to write in on that consultation so that we get the best outcome for the future, so that we can meet our climate change targets. We have to remember that the aviation industry is the biggest polluter around here in North Somerset District. It's going to grow. We're all going to have to reduce our emissions whilst the airport is allowed to increase their emissions.
Well, that's quite surprising, isn't it? But I come back to this whole business of at the very least the airport surely are doing something good for local people by cutting out all these other little car parks that are around there, because you know, it's all very well you're talking about adding these hard standings on the airfield itself, but if they're cutting down the car parking space in those local fields, that's actually surely good for the environment. It means more people are going to have to come by public transport into the airport when they go up, when they come back from their flights, and when they're going off for the day somewhere.
We certainly support public transport. In fact, we would like the bus rapid transit, if that gets off the ground, to go to the airport. So a big if. But this is one of the things that's been written into the planning application, and the planning application has been passed on a bus rapid transit coming and better public transport. And that is a big if.
Martin, can you just sum up here, where is it possible that we could ever in the future have a planning system which really does meet the needs of local people and also balances that with maybe the greater needs? Because obviously Bristol Airport is there really to service people from all over Europe, even all over the world, rather than just the locals.
I think people have got to be, you've got to have an overall plan of what you're trying to do, whether it's reducing carbon emissions or whatever. And transport policy has got to be, it's got to be integrated. It's got to be joined up. And ultimately, also, I think the planning system does need reform. It's very much biased in favour of developers, all sorts of developments, not just airports. They pretty much have a free run, and local authorities are scared to refuse planning permission because they know very well that they'll be taken to court and then they will lose because it'll be overruled by the centre. We've got to reform that. It's not fair. It's not balanced. It leads to bad decisions.
Hilary, what should local people do, or even people in other parts of the city who are concerned about the increase in air travel for whatever reason?
Well, they could reduce their flying themselves. They can go by train to Europe. They can just say, well, I'm going on one flight a year instead of two.
Well, I mean, going by train, it's not really practical, is it? It takes forever.
Well, the high-speed trains in France and Europe are fantastic. I've done it myself. And they are much, much cheaper than the trains here. Train fares should actually come down to encourage people to take the train rather than to fly.
Yes, they certainly should. I agree with that one. Anyway, Hilary Byrne from the campaign group Stop Bristol Airport Expansion, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, in 1975, BBC Bristol produced a 10-part children's TV series called The Changes. It was never repeated except more recently on UK Gold. The BBC said parents called in to say their children were disturbed by it. In The Changes, a teenager, Nikki Gore, finds herself in a deserted Bristol. Something started by a weird noise called the madness suddenly causes everybody to start smashing machines, cars, toasters, televisions. In fact, anything electrical is called evil. Power pylons become known as the bad wires, and Nikki has to rush underneath them saying, "They're awful, they frighten me, they're evil and wicked and dangerous." Well, it's a modern story based on a book, The Devil's Children, by Peter Dickinson, but it has its roots in a real movement of machine breakers, which began 200 years ago this month, known as the Luddites. In the north of England, the Luddites were men who started banding together to destroy newfangled machinery, which was replacing highly skilled manual workers in those dark satanic mills in the textile industry. Back in those days, there was no such thing as social security, so redundant workers and their families began to starve. Those desperate men swore oaths of secrecy, not unlike those of modern Freemasons, and set out to smash the devilish machines that had ruined their lives. These were the Luddites, and the term is still used today to describe people who don't want to use new technology, like mobile phones, for example. Well, Dave King is part of a group that's organising events to mark the 200th anniversary of the Luddites, and I spoke to him a few weeks ago about why he thinks the Luddites' struggle is still important today.
My name's Dave King, and I'm one of the members of the Luddites 200 Organising Forum, which is an ad hoc group that's been set up to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the Luddite uprisings in 1811 and 1812. I've been working for the last 20 years, actually, on issues related to the politics of technology, in my case particularly genetic engineering and human genetics issues, reproductive technologies. I've always been fond of the Luddites, and I'm the kind of person who actually gets called a Luddite quite often because I stand up and publicly criticise what scientists are doing. One thing I certainly want to try and achieve is for people to understand what the Luddites were about, and what they absolutely weren't about was about just destroying technology just because it was technology.
This is an expression which is used quite often about people that, for example, don't want a mobile phone. You know, you're a Luddite, you're in denial about the greatest new technological device.
Yeah, that's right. That use of the word actually was only invented in the 1950s, on the brink of the coming technological revolution of the 60s and 70s. The number one thing that people should remember about the Luddites is that they weren't opposed to all machinery or technology, but they had a phrase that they wanted to destroy machinery hurtful to the commonality, that's to say to the common good. And that was their practice, not merely their theory. When they went into workshops to smash up the machines, they smashed only the machines that they had a particular grudge against, and left a lot of other machines standing. So they had a quite selective approach, and they absolutely weren't people who wanted to go back to the Stone Age, is another phrase that that the nuclear lobby used to use.
So where does the word Luddite actually come from?
There's a lot of debate about that. The commonly accepted story is that it was a lad called Ned Ludd in Leicestershire in 1760 who had been beaten by his master for doing something wrong, and then he took up a big hammer and smashed up his loom. The story is a legend, but what's significant, I think, is the way the Luddites used the name King Ludd or General Ludd to signify their leader, but everybody knew that this person didn't actually exist. It was a clandestine organisation, but which didn't actually have a single leader, and so General Ludd could be anybody, basically.
So it was a fictitious person who all these acts were then blamed on, and any kind of notes left at the scene, were they signed by Ned Ludd or General Ludd?
Yes, or any of 100 permutations of that. Some of them, letters from the solicitor to General Ludd, and you know, all kinds of things. Yeah.
Okay. So whereabouts are we talking about historically? Which years and whereabouts in Britain?
We're talking about 1811, 1812 in Nottinghamshire, Yorkshire, and Lancashire primarily, were the three main centres.
And what were the machines that were the target?
All the groups of workers involved were textile workers, and in Nottinghamshire there was a type of machine called a wide frame. In Yorkshire, where the machine was that they were objected to was a shearing frame, which did the work that a group of workers called croppers did, which was finishing the nap of the wool cloth, which added an awful lot of value to that cloth. So they were very highly paid, skilled workers. And in Lancashire, it was power looms in the cotton industry and the massive mills that everybody thinks about as representing the Industrial Revolution. In the Lancashire case, those mills were attacked by large mobs, and a couple of them were destroyed by fire.
And this was done at night time then, was it?
Yes, certainly the Nottinghamshire and Yorkshire attacks were done by sometimes actually more than 100 men, but generally small bands of men who would descend on the factory in the middle of the night, having first given the owner an ultimatum to get rid of the machines or else. In Lancashire, actually, the attacks were, as I said, large mobs in the daytime, and actually that meant there was an awful lot more violence and casualties involved. Lots of women were involved in that as well. They were fighting for, I think, for their old way of doing things, for their trade and their craft and their pride in their trade and craft, which the machines were taking away, and taking away their livelihoods. We have to remember that this was at a period of massive economic depression due to the Napoleonic Wars. A couple of bad harvests had sent the price of bread through the roof. People were literally starving, and then on top of all this, the manufacturers were trying to introduce these new machines, which literally meant that the men out of work and their families would starve. So they were really pushed into a corner, and they had in fact spent the previous 10 years petitioning Parliament to actually enforce laws which were already in place, which prevented the introduction of machines that displaced people's jobs. They'd exhausted all those avenues, and Parliament repealed all the old legislation at the behest of the manufacturers. So they were really in a very tight corner, and certainly I would say, had I been there at that time, I would have been doing the same thing, because they were just trying to survive.
If you're going to do something like that, you've got to make sure you don't get caught, because certainly after a while it became a capital offence. You know, you could be hanged for machine breaking. So how did they manage to evade capture, and to what extent did they manage to do that?
Well, they did succeed very well for a year before authorities were really able to capture some of the key members in Yorkshire. And likewise in Nottinghamshire, although there were a few arrests made early on, relatively few people were caught. And the reason was, these were very close-knit communities of workers who everybody knew everybody else and knew who was a framework knitter or a cropper. So although the Home Office tried with spies and with thousands and thousands of troops stationed in the north of England to infiltrate those groups, they weren't able to do it. And the communities, whole communities, supported the Luddites because they were suffering too. And so it really was a kind of, the Luddites were kind of the sort of spearhead of a popular uprising, really, I would call it. They were trade union organisations, although at that period the Parliament, again at the behest of the manufacturers, had made trade unions illegal in 1799, the Combination Act. So they had 10 years of practice of operating in a clandestine way. Yeah, they were very good at that, and the authorities really couldn't penetrate it at all.
The manufacturers of these new machines were also supplying equipment to the Luddites to smash them up.
What you're referring to is one particular blacksmith called Enoch Taylor of Marsden in near Huddersfield in Yorkshire. Yes, he made the machines for the shearing machines for the manufacturers, but he also made massive sledgehammers, which were known as Enoch hammers, which the Luddites then used to smash up the machines. And they had a slogan: when they went into a factory, they would shout, "Enoch hath made them, Enoch shall break them." I mean, I don't know whether, you know, Enoch Taylor had that kind of business strategy to increase his demand or whatever, but it's quite interesting that he ended up making both halves of the equation.
Were they successful then, the Luddites, ultimately?
I would regard it as basically a revolt against the Industrial Revolution and the free market system that was, you know, really coming into its own at that period. And I would say their defeat marks the decisive victory of that system which we've had for the last 200 years. Having said that, they did have some local and temporary gains in Nottinghamshire. Certainly for a while the manufacturers acceded to the workers' demands for better pay and to stop using the wide frames. Also to some extent in Lancashire, I think. But it's also sad to say that, yes, 5 years after the end of the Luddite revolt, there'd been 1,700 or so croppers in West Yorkshire in employment, and 5 years later there were less than 100. So, yeah, they lost in that sense. But I think their spirit has carried on and, you know, pops up again and again in people's resistance to new technologies. You know, I mean, I've worked on issues around genetic engineering and GM foods, and also about cloning and design of babies. And then there have been great campaigns in the last 20, 30 years who consciously or unconsciously represent the spirit of the Luddites. And I think the GM campaign is an example of great success, actually, that people can, if we decide that this new technology that's being pushed upon us by the corporations and the scientific establishment is hurtful to commonality, then we actually can win. We have largely kept GM food out of the food chain in Britain and most of Europe. Their spirit has certainly continued, and Luddism was never about being against technology, but I think nowadays what it means is being sceptical about the religion of technology that we have, you know, that's constantly pushed at us, you know, get this latest new gadget and everything will be fine, medical research will make the future wonderful, and all the hype that goes with it. And I saw recently a survey of British public opinion on science, and there were really large minorities and in some cases majorities of people with very sceptical attitudes, who are very suspicious of scientists and what they're doing, don't like the way science is tampering with nature and doing things behind closed doors and so on, and having, you know, people having quite a sort of savvy, I think, attitude to new technologies that actually the scientific establishment finds very threatening and will routinely label as anti-science or Luddite or something. I want people to reclaim the term and be able to proudly say that they're a sceptic about new technologies, but obviously recognising the benefits as well.
Just getting back to the historical Luddites from 200 years ago, were there any owners that actually said, well, actually, I think maybe the best thing to do is just to keep employing these people and not to bring in these new machines?
Pressure on the manufacturers in some cases bore fruit, particularly in Nottinghamshire, I think. In Yorkshire, also quite a lot, although the one or two of the larger manufacturers with the big mills kind of banded together and decided to really resist the Luddites strongly, and that led to the sort of culminating episode in Yorkshire at Rawfold's mill in April of 1812, in which the owner of the mill, William Cartwright, had the mill defended by troops, and he'd even got gallon jars of acid up at the top of his mill to pour down on people trying to invade it. It was almost like a medieval siege he'd set up there. So when the Luddites came with, I think, about 300 people, they weren't able to get into the mill. Two of the Luddites were killed, and there's a nice story actually about that attack, which is the centrepiece of Shirley by Charlotte Bronte. And one of the men who was shot and who was dying was being attended by the local priest, who was a rabid anti-Luddite, the Reverend Hammond Robeson. And Robeson was trying to get information out of the man as to who the leaders were, you know, who his fellow Luddites were. And eventually, just as he was on the point of dying, the man said, can you keep a secret? And Robeson thought, yes, my son, I can keep a secret. So can I. And the man died. So the Luddites kept their secrets to their grave as old men in many cases. They wouldn't talk about who had been involved. They had really blood-curdling oaths of secrecy, which said, you know, if I ever betray the members of this group, then I expect to be speedily sent out of this world by the first brother who meets me. It was really serious business they were involved in.
Do you think that there are things that we can learn today about dealing with some of the excesses of science? You mentioned things like cloning, possibility of designer babies, this kind of thing.
I think one thing we can learn is that resistance is possible, and sometimes you can win, and on specific issues. And I think we're in a whole phase now, what with climate change and peak oil, we're in a phase where it's becoming evident that the Western lifestyle that's been built up in the second half of the 20th century simply cannot continue. We are going to have to change our society in many ways, and part of that will be a technological change and using technologies that are much more sustainable and are not geared purely to making profit for corporations. We have to rethink our technological future as well, and I think that's going to be a very interesting and exciting new direction for people to empower themselves and say, actually, yes, I have a right to determine what technologies, you know, are used in societies. It's not that right doesn't just belong to corporations and, you know, scientific elites. People's empowerment in that area is going to be fundamental to building a sustainable future.
Now, you mentioned Charlotte Bronte. Are there any other popular culture of its time, and are there any good books on the Luddites?
There certainly are. I mean, the best book on the Luddites, which kind of analyses the actual history and as well as the current issues, is called Rebels Against the Future by Kirkpatrick Sale. It was written in about 1997. There are a couple of Luddite novels based on those episodes. Apart from Charlotte Bronte, there's one called Benna Bills, The Luddite. As it was such a popular uprising, not surprising, there were a lot of songs were written. In fact, one of the things we're trying to do with our project this year is to gather those together. Songs are from Nottinghamshire and Yorkshire mainly, and in fact, in November in Leeds, we're holding a benefit gig, and we're going to, well, part of that will be a performance of some of the songs, like the Cropper Lads and Foster's Mill from Yorkshire. Yeah. Our website address is www.luddites200.org.uk, and we've got a blog as well, which is going to will be linked to that. And yeah, there's a number of other websites. There's a one called Luddite Bicentenary, which is a blog which is kind of going through the anniversary sort of almost day by day, you know, and talking about the different events that happened back then. So there's quite a bit of material out on the web. There's some videos on YouTube that are quite good. And
also, the Luddites were kind of the beginning of a whole movement against the Industrial Revolution as it rolled on to different areas. Can you just give us a brief outline of some of the other rebellions that happened in other parts of the country against technology after the Luddites as part of the Industrial Revolution?
Well, the most well-known one was the Captain Swing riots, which was in the 1830s in the southern part of England. In that case, it was threshing machines that were the target because they were destroying, you know, the livelihoods of agricultural labourers. And so, yeah, there was a big and actually very successful campaign which delayed the introduction of threshing machines for a long time in the south of England. There were also, I mean, episodes of machine breaking in other parts of the world. In the USA, in France, we get the word sabotage from sabot, which is clogs, which the French workers, loom weavers, would wear, and then they would use to smash the new power looms that were being introduced just around the time of the French Revolution. And in fact, I've just learned this weekend that there was an episode in China in the 1920s of, again, against machine breaking, against the introduction of new power looms. Yeah.
Isn't there an underlying thing here, Dave, that you've got technology coming in as it has is to today too, as it was then? Ultimately, you've got a big working population. As this technology comes in, you need less and less and less workers, and so numbers of the population actually who aren't working in agriculture or anything like that become totally superfluous.
This is clearly the case. I mean, it's definitely been a trend throughout the whole of the second half of the 20th century with automation of a lot of industrial production. And yeah, it's an underlying structural unemployment which is there, never underneath the variations that go on through because of economic booms and busts. It's an issue, you know, which is continuing. In fact, I've just met somebody this weekend, a librarian who is being put, you know, basically being put out of his job because they've introduced these new machines in libraries that allow people to check their own books in and out. So it's absolutely, and there's the same thing is going on in a variety of different ways as part of the ways in which the government is cutting the public sector funding. One of the ways it's doing that is by introducing new technology and decreasing its labour bills. So, yeah, this is an ongoing thing. And I really think that it's time now that the trade union movement took this issue on again, rather than, you know, kind of automatically agreeing with manufacturers who say it'll lead to increased productivity, and for us all to kind of change our attitude towards work, really. You know, that, I mean, for a lot of manufacturers, labour and having to pay a wages bill is a kind of unfortunate necessity of their enterprise. But I think we need to think about the role of industrial company and of any company is to actually provide employment for people, and not merely to make the highest amount of profits for its shareholders.
Well, see, the thing is, the technology has the promise of freeing up people for more and more leisure time. Actually, what seems to be happening is people are being impoverished by it, and society is being divided into those that control the technology and everyone else who desperately needs a livelihood.
That's right. I mean, people often say, you know, well, it's great if we have all these new machines because people will be able to work less. In our industrial capitalist economy, it just doesn't work like that. Well, one thing, it's clear that it won't produce more leisure time, because leisure costs money these days. Walking around the countryside is maybe free for some people, although you have to get there, and that costs money if you live in a city. It just doesn't work that way in a capitalist economy, that we'll all be freed up. You know, our job is to work in order to earn the money to then be able to consume, and the whole system is geared to making that cycle go round and round and round more and more. if you can't fit into that cycle because you don't have the right skills, you're not going to be left with loads of leisure, you're just going to be poor. So the Luddites 200 organising forum website is www.luddites200.org.uk, and there are some links on that on the site to other related sites and blogs. And next year we're hoping to organise a summer gathering for people interested in the politics of technology, and we're trying to bring together trade unionists and campaigners on issues like GM and nuclear, and people into alternative technologies. I think we're trying to develop a new Luddite politics, basically. But we're also planning next year to hold a sort of cultural festival with some of the music and some theatre performances and demonstrations of the kind of technology that was being displaced by the new machines.
Unashamed Luddite there, Dave King, talking to me a couple of weeks ago down in Devon. Now, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, what are your thoughts about all this? Dave seems absolutely convinced that the Luddites are still relevant today. And one of the terms he uses there is structural unemployment. I mean, I wonder whether we're in a similar sort of situation now, where there is everybody's been told they've got to get a job, but there actually aren't enough jobs to go around. The sums don't actually add up now.
Well, that's why you need something like a citizen's income, because as technology advances, we should be able to have more leisure time, but we've got to plan it. And that means as people are replaced by machinery, they need to get a dividend from the society. Basically, a citizen's income or negative income tax, basically everybody gets paid a basic wage just for being who they are, and then of course they can work on top of that 1 hour, 2 hours, 40 hours, and we need to build a more balanced lifestyle. Our technology ought to be our servant, not our master.
Now all this happens because basically people have to have money, because they don't have land to grow food, they don't have their own home, most people anyway, and how did that happen? I mean, surely, begin with, everybody had some land.
Not really. I mean, basically, what you had is a serf.
Well, we had a peasant economy,
basically, people were slaves of the feudal
landowners.
I mean,
in medieval Britain, you didn't actually pay money rent for where you lived. You would simply give service to the lord of the manor.
Yeah, well, yes, in other words, you were a slave. So that's not necessarily
a vassal.
A vassal was a bit higher up. You know, you were a serf or a villein.
But at least you had security of tenure in those days. It wasn't as if your landlord could knock on the door and say, sorry, you're out at the end of
well,
the
I mean, basically it was a different way of doing things. I mean, it is relevant to the modern world, because we've still got nearly half of humanity living in rural areas, and that doesn't have to be a terrible fate. It can actually be a positive thing for people. We don't actually want to urbanise much more than we've already done, and that means that we've got to really improve the quality in rural areas, particularly in the developing world. There's no reason why peasant farmers can't be happy, healthy, educated, and
in Italy, actually, a lot of the Italian with people who own small farms are actually very, very cultured people, and so I think you're absolutely right there. But one of the reasons that we had a situation with the Luddites, where they were working in the factories and they were very skilled, but that skill didn't mean anything anymore, was because they didn't have anywhere to live. They didn't have their own place to live.
Well, they had little cottages where they used to actually...
They would then be evicted because they didn't have any wages.
Yeah, well, the putting out system was that they didn't work in factories. They worked at home on hand looms, and it was very skilled work. And, of course, what happened is that instead of a skilled guy working at home on his loom... And of course the bosses used to really hate the handloom weavers, because they famously never worked on Mondays. And, by the end of the week, they got themselves together and started to work. Because, basically, they were more interested in leisure time than they were in working. So they would only work as much as they wanted to in order to earn enough money to do what they wanted to do.
Well, what I'm coming around to here is the talking about enclosure, because enclosure was a very, actually, really socially destructive idea. It was landowners' parliaments the sort of 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 1800s, where only landowners could vote. And what they were doing, basically, was voting themselves the land. This was privatisation of land over the centuries.
And simultaneously creating a landless proletariat, which could then be sent to working factories because they've got no
alternative. And these were a lot of these people were the Luddite.
This is going on all over the world as we speak today, the same kind of process.
In other parts of the world.
Still going on.
Absolutely right. So what about, we're talking about privatisation there of, the land, we're talking about the Luddites. What about resistance to this, though, in times like the English Civil War?
Well, you're jumping backwards.
But there has been resistance to these sorts of changes.
Listen, people always resist. In China today, for example, there's lots of development going on where people, corrupt local officials are building skyscrapers or airports or whatever and just driving local farmers off their land. It leads to all kinds of strikes, riots and opposition. Every society will have resistance. When people have got their backs on the wall and they've got no choice, they fight back. They haven't got any alternative.
Yes, well, I'm thinking really of the Levellers and the Diggers in the Civil War. The Levellers were a movement within the army which wanted more democracy, that is to say a parliament that represented women, for example.
They didn't say women.
The Leveller women there were
demands for women's suffrage, but not from the mainstream Levellers.
The mainstream levers
wanted manhood suffrage. I'm not saying that, that these questions were not raised, but I mean...
And the Leveller women took a partition to Parliament as well. So they were Levellers. Anyway, let's not get bogged down there, but there was a real upswell of ideas. The other thing, of course, was the Chartists. They came along after the...
That's the 1840s, right? Yeah.
And now we've got this kind of Occupy movement. I'm not saying this is necessarily the same as the Chartists, but they also have a list of demands, just like the Levellers, the Diggers had demands, the Chartists had demands, now we've got demands about things like tax havens from the Occupy movement.
Yes, and I think ultimately, you see, people like the Luddites, they had no trade unions because they were illegal, they couldn't vote, so what recourse did they have? I mean, there was no social security, and of course they took the only way that the things were open to them to try and better their circumstances. But ultimately what you need is a society that's properly organised to look after the ordinary people, and their interests should come first.
Well, now just about everything else has been privatised, our genes included. What about war? War on Want have brought out several excellent reports recently on this aspect of the War on Terror, which has barely been touched by the mainstream press in Britain. DynCorp, XE Services, that used to be called Blackwater, the Olive Group, which were responsible for installing hundreds of illegal CCTV cameras on a predominantly Muslim estate in Birmingham that then had to be removed earlier this year. Sandline is another one, but these are just a few of those private military companies, or PMCs, run often by former Special Forces, MI6 and CIA veterans, have been shown to be running even some of them secret assassination squads. Ali Machon is a former MI5 officer, and here she reveals some secret techniques that spies like her use to influence people, and expresses her concern about what she saw in her job as an officer in MI5 as the privatisation of security and the privatisation of war.
The people you're talking about are then defined as agents, so they're sort of like contractors, and they are employed by MI5 to infiltrate organisations, or to go and bug people's houses or whatever. So they're the sort of cutouts. They are the ones who do have to befriend people in groups, are the ones who betray those friendships and report back. And it's an interesting psychological study of why people will do that. MI5 always had this thing which they had a little acronym for, which was MICE, which was money, idealism, compromise and ego. So you could buy someone to do it, they would do it for ideological belief, you caught them out in an embarrassing situation and blackmailed them, or you flattered them. You basically said, come on, do something really good. We know you can do it and nobody else can. Mm-hmm. So that was how they got the agents to infiltrate these groups. However, in the UK, what we've seen worryingly in the last few years is a sort of explosion in private security firms as well. In the US, notoriously, we have Blackwater, which has gone into Iraq and murdered people with legal impunity. But in the UK, we have other companies like Kroll or Diligence, which in fact was set up by one of my ex-colleagues and is doing very well. And they get paid by big corporations primarily to go and spy on activist groups. So, an arms company is worried about some protesters, they buy the services of these companies, or environmental camps and things like that. So there's a sort of the official spies who have very little oversight anyway from the government. Then you have the unofficial spies, many of whom are former ex-spooks anyway. doing all this stuff completely outside the law.
What would be the, to your knowledge, the split now between the official spies who are paid by the government and these contract spies? I mean, how... I've read figures in the U.S. that Blackwater is huge. It's the largest private army in the world. Yeah. But what's the situation, to your knowledge, in the U.K.?
From what I've seen, very similar. MI5 in my day had about 2,000 full-time staff. And out of that, there would probably be about 400 or 500 intelligence officers, and the rest were support staff. Now they have virtually doubled that number. But that's still quite a small organisation. And then, of course, you have the agents around that organisation who are infiltrating the groups. In terms of the commercial companies, they are massive. I mean, we're talking many, many large companies. And there have been a series of scandals over the last few years revealed in the UK press of people who have been caught out spying on these activist groups. So, you know, who can tell what's happening with meetings like this as well? Certainly in the UK, there may well be infiltration from MI5 agents. I would say there almost certainly would be infiltration from the police, because there's a sort of second tier of intelligence work in the UK where we have the secret police doing this sort of thing. And possibly as well, of course, these commercial spies. And they could actually all be running around treading each other's toes as well. Because
they normally don't know each other,
exactly,
do they?
Exactly. Yeah. So they can cause each other problems as well.
That was former MI5 officer Annie Machon there, speaking about 18 months ago in Canada to Barry Zwicker. Martin, this is a bit nerve-wracking, isn't it? Because not only have we got the privatisation of war here, we've also got private companies paying these private spies and private military companies.
Yes, it's a very dark area, isn't it? Look at the Homeland Security in the United States. I understand it has up to 1 million employees, directly and indirectly, and the subcontracting chains allow all sorts of skullduggery to go on without any kind of oversight whatsoever.
Well, apparently, this is a British commander in southern Afghanistan in May 2010. Actually, he was Major General Nick Carter, said the culture of impunity exists in Afghanistan with these private military companies. We have no systems for registering either weapons or vehicles.
Yes, and all sorts of things can go on. I mean, the subcontracting, as I say, allows... There's no oversight. It's a thicket, and nobody knows what's going on. The CIA, for example, has been broken into hundreds of separate private organisations, subcontracted out. This is all done on government money, of course. Although it's private sector, it's ultimately the taxpayer who foots the bill, even though they haven't got a clue what's going on.
Well, some of the companies involved are the 39 registered PMSCs. Well, they're PMCs, which is private military companies, or now the term is generally used as PMSCs, private military and security companies. Out of the 39 registered in Afghanistan, 10 are from Britain, more than from any country apart from Afghanistan itself. The UK companies are Aegis, Armour Group, Blue Hackle, Control Risks Group, Edinburgh International, Global Security, IDG Security, Olive Security, Page Associates and Saladin.
A lot of these people would have been trained at taxpayer expense in our special forces and in our spying establishment. And then, of course, they go off with their training to make a packet for working for private enterprises run by corporates, faceless corporate bureaucrats.
Martin, do you agree with me that there's a little bit of a fascist edge to this, with lack of oversight, profit being made from spying and blowing people up?
Well, we know, because the US government has been absolutely clear about it, there is a massive assassination program. They make no secret of it. They don't totally outside the rule of law, completely illegal, but they just think they can do what they like. Now, of course, what they've got to remember is if there's no rules, there's no rules, and don't go crying for your mummy when that game starts going for real. Like, as we've seen in Afghanistan, they're training up the local police, they're training up the local army, and once they've got trained up, what's the first thing they do? They put a bullet through the head of the trainer. That's what happened in Vietnam, it's what's happening in Afghanistan, and what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, now we return to take another look at an invite-only leadership charity, Common Purpose. The council, the BBC, the police and other public services. Do some of their so-called graduates have their fingers in the till, placing orders for more training from Common Purpose? Or is their course so good it's public money well spent?
My name's Mike. I've been doing some Freedom of Information requests since about 2007 regarding a leadership training organisation called Common Purpose.
What was the thing that first interested you in this Common Purpose?
My brother-in-law initially brought them to my attention. They were doing some training in his council, and the council had paid them something like £8,000 or £9,000 over a period of a couple of months. And I thought I'd put some FOI requests out locally about them, and I've been doing that now on and off for a couple of years.
So how does the Freedom of Information Act work, and what kind of information are you allowed to demand, in fact, to see?
Well, initially we were putting FOI, Freedom of Information Request out, which everybody can do for free through local councils, regional development associations and police forces. And we were amazed at the amount that these companies were paying Common Purpose for training, literally hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Of public money. Now, what's the problem with that? Because obviously every council, every police force, every fire service, etc., does need training.
Well, yeah, what we found out initially was we collated the information, and then what was evident was that a lot of these orders were being given to Common Purpose by Common Purpose graduates or associates inside the councils and police forces, which another word for that is insider dealing.
Well, it's in fact, I would have imagined that if you're involved in a decision about giving money to an organisation which you're actually a member of, then actually you should step outside that meeting, otherwise you are committing, potentially anyway, a criminal offence.
Well, a lot of these meetings weren't official council or police or public body meetings. They were Common Purpose meetings where Common Purpose graduates and advisory group members who also work for councils and police forces were actually meeting to discuss Common Purpose, but also finances for that particular public body. So it was done outside the democratic process.
People do need to be trained in how to be authoritative, confident leaders.
Yeah, they do, but everything a council does has to be for the benefit of the ratepayer. And when we were asking councils to demonstrate benefits of sending people on Common Purpose courses, they couldn't.
What about the BBC? Because I know that quite a lot of people of the BBC, and in Bristol specifically, have been trained on these Common Purpose courses. Is that all above board?
What we've also found out was that a lot of these public bodies, including the BBC, are very, very reluctant to share information that we have got a right to see.
Well, hang on a minute, because if you want to see an order or an invoice under the Freedom of Information Act from the BBC as a publicly funded body, they should just simply hand it over.
Well, let me tell you, a friend of mine put a Freedom of Information request out fairly recently, only a few months back, to the BBC in Bristol, where the BBC had actually contracted Common Purpose to the tune of £17,000 for some bespoke training. And when we initially asked to see the invoice, it was refused.
So did you then pursue that? And what can you do if someone simply writes back to you and says, sorry, mate, you can't have that information?
We told them that we, as taxpayers to the BBC, we had a right to actually see the information. So we put a complaint in. We also asked to see a copy of the order that went to Common Purpose. We did eventually get to see the invoice, but they wouldn't actually send us a copy of the order.
So the person actually giving that order, are you saying that they may also have been someone who is a member of this organisation?
I know the person who procured it had actually attended Common Purpose events, but what we found was that the majority of Common Purpose contracts up and down the UK, all over the UK, from institutions in Wales, Scotland and England, the majority of the orders that are procured are generally procured by people associated or graduates of Common Purpose.
People who are being trained by an organisation may think, well, that was good training, I want to make sure more people get that training. And it's not Common Purpose looking after their own, it's just simply that they're the best people to do the training in the field.
No, this is not correct. Common Purpose are quite worried about the information that we'd uncovered. And I don't run a website, but I've put some of the material out to people. It's found its way on websites. And they were so worried about what we'd uncovered is that somehow they managed to collect data from quite a few people who were actually putting legitimate FOI requests out to public bodies. Now, this shows you the relationship that they have with their graduates and associates. So much to say that our names, addresses and telephone numbers appeared on a blacklist that they then circulated back out into the other public bodies to stop us actually seeing this information. So much for openness.
How did you get to see the blacklist with your name on it then? Because that's a whole point of a blacklist is it's secret.
Well, yeah, it was intended to be secret, but as an individual, you have a right by law under a subject access request to see any data. that any public body holds about you. So a simple proof of ID and £10, and you can see everything they hold. And what happened was that Common Purpose collected our names and addresses through their associates and graduates. Now, literally, we know for a fact that their own graduates were passing our names on verbally, and our names and addresses verbally, and our Freedom of Information request at Common Purpose Advisory Group meetings.
So, effectively, just simply by making a Freedom of Information request about Common Purpose, you're saying that then that you may not get the information that you were after. You may simply end up just being added to a blacklist, which isn't just simply used by Common Purpose, but by other organisations such as councils and police where Common Purpose graduates are active.
Our names were on this list. There's other names on there, people that we don't know. We reported Common Purpose to the Information Commissioner, and the Information Commissioner basically ruled that they did break the law, and they not only broke it once, but several times. I've got evidence that they're still actually collating people's names. Now, I don't know whether they're distributing them, but they are still asking and inquiring as to who is making these requests. Why?
Some of the councillors, some of the council officers have been very upset about what you're doing, but surely not all of them.
I've spoken and met with several councillors from large councils, and they have been amazed at what their council has been doing. And in fact, they've actually been very, very helpful in inquiring as to the activities of Common Purpose inside their own councils. So it's not just a matter of fact that, you know, a few things have found their way onto websites where people have analysed them and made comment about them. Actual councillors from county councils and some big city councils have been very, very interested, and they've actually thanked me and some of my friends for presenting the material to them.
You're painting a picture here of a lot of our public organisations, the police, the BBC and local authorities, maybe even central government, being sort of split between people who are there to serve the people and others who are there to garner funds for their own organisation. Do you think that's fair to say?
Well, the paperwork that I've got demonstrate that favouritism and cronyism is rife. It is absolutely rife regarding the dealings of Common Purpose orders. This has been going on for years and years and years, but it's not been uncovered because the Freedom of Information Act 2000 that got put on ice by Tony Blair for 5 years only came into effect in February 2005. So people couldn't have got access to the information because Common Purpose has been going for quite a few years. But it's only since 2006 onwards where people have been able to get a picture of how much taxpayers' money has been going to fund Common Purpose graduates, who are mainly people on £50,000, £60,000, £70,000, £100,000 a year we're talking about. Senior civil servants, bankers. I mean, they actually brag on their website that they've trained the FTSE 100 companies. So we're wondering who actually benefits. Not only that, they've had over £3 million worth of lottery money over the past few years.
How do you know whether a particular individual, a public servant or banker or whoever, is a Common Purpose graduate? Do they publish a list of the names of people who've been through their courses?
Well, in the early days, they were quite happy. Even on their website, they used to name hundreds of people, their graduates. And then suddenly, when we started to put FOI requests in, all these people disappeared. Literally overnight. So, I mean, that just demonstrates what I said earlier, that the majority of orders that they were getting were done via their graduates or associates.
Can you give us an idea of what it's like to go on one of these Common Purpose graduate courses?
I've asked some councillors to inquire. I mean, there's nothing, really nothing, that Common Purpose do that local councils and police forces can actually do themselves, because for me, it's just money for old rope. The average course for an individual is about £4,500, £5,000, and all they basically do is meet people from their area, say in Bristol or Bradford, and there's just the council could organise this themselves for probably a tenth of the price. So for me, it is absolute waste of money, and we're talking about millions of pounds per year.
It's supposed to be leadership training. I mean, they must be doing some kind of leadership training as part of these courses.
I've spoken to councillors who've actually spoken at some of these meetings, and one councillor actually blogs about it, and he was actually dismayed at the level of intelligence that was displayed by some of the people on the courses.
Now, we've also heard most recently that Chris Patton is earmarked to be the chairman of the trust of the BBC in the future. He's also, I think, connected with Common Purpose, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Chris Patton actually sits on the Common Purpose India group, which is made up of Indian businessmen and some, you know, Chris Patton and Boris Johnson's brother. But Chris Patton is a big supporter of Common Purpose, like so many other senior civil servants, and he has spoken at some of their events over the years. I've no doubt that he knows the chief executive. Now, this to me is a little bit worrying. Now, he is a Europhile. These are the type of people that Common Purpose associate themselves. They talk about diversity, but most of the people they associate with and that speak at their events have all got very, very similar views.
What are those views?
Well, I'm a libertarian. I believe in free speech. I believe that, you know, the UK should be a sovereign nation. And a majority of people who actually speak at their events are totally the opposite. Leon Britton, he's another sort of favourite supporter of theirs. They do seem to have people of a very, very similar mould. Most of the people speaking and associated with Common Purpose on a higher level despise the nation state. But I think at a lower level, we need to be wary of Common Purpose. The amount of money that is actually going into their pockets for no tangible benefits.
That was Mike there, as an investigator, Freedom of Information Request, telling quite a lot about, particularly about Common Purpose, speaking to me a few weeks ago. Now, Mark Martin, do you see a problem here? Or is he getting a bit paranoid about this organisation?
Well, I mean, there ought to be transparency, oughtn't there? We need to know what's going
on. And if the Information Commissioner is saying that they're breaking the law by constructing this blacklist...
Well, yes. I mean, who else gets to do training? Is it just Common Purpose, or are there other companies in the field, as it were? If they get all of the training and nobody else gets a look in, it starts to look rather sinister, doesn't it? And in any case, what is the training? Surely they can tell us. These are public officials. What do you do in these meetings? What are you being trained in?
Well, they've been trained in leadership, apparently, and also one of the things that they're alleged to do in these is to talk about their sort of vulnerabilities and weaknesses, and this all goes down in a file. Anyway, before we finish, we're nearly coming up to 7 o'clock and the Fresh Blood Party, and we're just going to have a quick look at the Tunisian elections. This was at the start of the Arab Spring, lots of promise in Tunisia, but Martin, we hear that there's been rioting and curfews in Tunisian towns because some of the most popular people who were elected in Tunisia, their election results have been annulled. So what's going on here?
Well, it's hard to know. We're sitting in Bristol. Knowing what's going on in Tunisia is difficult to grasp.
Well, I can tell you, the Electoral Commission decided to annul victories by three candidates of the Popular Petition Party. And for more than a decade, Hashmi from the party used his London base and a satellite TV channel to broadcast homespun analysis of his country's political scene. Apparently, the streets used to be deserted when they were broadcasting. But he's now been told, you cannot be an MP. You've got the people voted for you, but you can't be an MP.
Well... this is something that's worrying. Let's see what happens in elections in Egypt, in September, because of course there are many hundreds of activists still languishing in prison in Egypt, and of course the powers that be, they want to control the outcome of elections. They always have.
It's a bit of a shame. So the Arab Spring giving promise there. But anyway, that's all the serious talk out of the way. Because after Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 7, Friday night is Music Night, 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party crew. Next week, we say just say KNOW to Bristol's various drug priorities. Our website is thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gilson.